From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat, and it's Friday. That means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We'll get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Kalama Hines, reporter with EastIdahoNews.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Nicole Blanchard, the Idaho Statesman's outdoors reporter, and Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman. What a lineup. Hi, everybody.
Happy Friday, Sam.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Hey, happy Friday.
Hey, okay, so we've got a lot of legislative news this week, but I want to start outside the legislature first. And Ian, let's start with you. Ada County Commissioners this week turned down Boise Mayor Lauren McClain's request for more money to keep paying for hotel rooms for people experiencing homelessness. Give us a rundown. What is the story?
Yeah, so I think a lot of this conflict amounts to sort of a philosophical difference between the Republican-controlled commission and Boise's Democratic mayor over responsibility to provide services for unhoused people and sort of what those services should entail. So to give listeners some background, since the start of COVID, basically, Interfaith Sanctuary, which is a nonprofit that provides services for unhoused people in Boise, has been putting people up in a hotel room, in hotel rooms at a hotel in Boise. It started as a measure to separate people who had tested positive for COVID from the rest of the population at the shelter. And now the hotel is largely used for pretty vulnerable people, people who are medically fragile or seniors in need of care, as well as families with children who are experiencing homelessness. And the money to pay for these hotel rooms has been drawn from a number of federal programs over the past few years, a lot of them related to the emergency provisions that the government put in place related to the pandemic. But what's happened now is those funds are starting to run out. And last year, Boise's mayor, Lauren McClain, she asked the Ada County Commission to provide more funding for these hotel rooms, basically as she sees it as a sort of a stopgap measure. Interfaith Sanctuary is in the process of building a new shelter on State Street that's planned to open by sometime in the spring of next year. And so the thought is that the people staying at the hotel, once that new shelter is opened, will be able to stay at that new shelter. But in the meantime, they feel there's a need for these people to have somewhere to stay at this hotel. But the commission in December, instead of providing funding through early next year, they only provided funding for a shorter period of time through mid-April of this year. And this week, they then turned down the mayor's request to provide further funding through the rest of the year. And this is something that has therefore caused conflict because the mayor feels like now the city is responsible for paying for something that's really a region-wide problem. And so it's caused a lot of upset, I think, within her administration.
She put out a pretty harsh statement when the commissioners declined to get more money, saying things like, she didn't want to see tent cities like in Portland or San Francisco, and that this was the way to keep very vulnerable people housed.
Yeah, she said she was shocked and deeply dismayed by their decision. And I should point out that she says that she's committed to finding a way through her own means of figuring out a way to fund these rooms through the rest of the year. But as I said, I think she feels like Boise's being made solely responsible for addressing these issues and that the county's not supporting her. On the reverse side, the county said in their meeting earlier this week that they'd made it clear to the city that the funding that they'd given between December and April was money that they expected it to give the city time to find another way to fund the measures. So that's sort of their view on the situation.
So we're not sure what the mayor might do at this point, but she says she's going to do something because if Interfaith Sanctuary could pick up the slack, you said it's not until next year.
Right. They Interfaith plans to have space to house these people when they open their new shelter, but that's still pending. And there actually are a number of that new shelter has received opposition from neighbors, and there's a pending lawsuit against it. But it is planned to open next year.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see. Jimmy, we're going to head to the legislature, because why not? There's a bill that would bar libraries from lending materials deemed harmful to minors without parental permission. It's moving through the legislature. What is it? And Melissa, you've been heavy into legislature, so jump in as well.
Yeah, so this bill is the second or third attempt. I lose count at this point with so many bills flying around. But a previous version of the bill died in a House committee, specifically the House Education Committee. This one, they reduced the civil penalty. So essentially under the bill, any library that lends whatever would be deemed harmful material to anyone under 18 without parental permission could sue that library for $2,500. It had been $10,000. That was a sticking point with some of the opponents who said that that was too much, especially for, you know, smaller rural libraries whose entire yearly budget, you know, is only like $150,000, one person testified a couple weeks ago. So this actually went before the House State Affairs Committee, which is much more conservative, I would say, than the House Education Committee, or at least the votes were certainly there. So this the way that it would define harmful materials is any sort of sexual conduct or sexual arousal, any description of those things or nudity. That, you know, essentially plays to or that the community would find objectionable or obscene. And so it's pretty subjective, which is something opponents pointed out. Like, there's no hard and fast rule as to what would be considered obscene. Librarians who testified against it said, look, none of these materials that you have been concerned about, which include everything from sexual education manuals or books with like LGBTQ themes or drug use would qualify as obscene under the actual legal definition of obscenity, which is, you know, something lawmakers rejected. They said, oh, it's pretty plain that we can see that this is, you know, harmful to kids. Even one of the people who spoke in favor of the bill, he was actually the first up yesterday to testify, brought in a copy of Hustler and, you know, flipped to the centerfold and showed all the legislators on the committee, you know, what was going on in that particular issue, and said, what's the difference between this and a cartoon drawing that he said he got at a public library that included nude images of adults? So that passed out of the House State Affairs Committee. It's actually potentially going to be taken up today. I haven't checked. I've got the feed up right now. And apparently the House is doing an Irish celebration for St. Patrick's Day with some Irish dancers. But it potentially could be taken up today.
Wow. Okay, Melissa, jump in. You've been watching all these library bills as well. Is this bill going to pass? Is this the second or third time the charm?
It's hard to say. The makeup of the Senate has changed a lot since last year and that key Senate State Affairs Committee, where the library bill that passed last year hit a hurdle, didn't even get a hearing. New chairman, new members of the committee this year, a very, very different dynamic. So again, hard to say. I do want to emphasize, you know, there are not copies of Hustler in the libraries next to Ranger Rick in the kids section. It's just not there. There are books that people were concerned about that are widely available in a lot of these libraries. Some of them are in the young adult section, some of them are in the adult section. But the Hustler moment yesterday really stood out to me when I heard about it, because it was it was notable. I've never seen a copy of Hustler in a legislative meeting, but hey, first time for everything.
Well, it certainly is a hot button issue that some lawmakers are really trying to get through in some form or another this year. And we've got you know, more on libraries coming up next week in the non-legislative realm. I mean, it's just a topic that's not going to stop.
It's definitely a hot button issue, not just in Idaho, but around the country. There are a lot of parents concerned about what children have access to in libraries and how much steering librarians do to make sure kids aren't checking out materials that are inappropriate for their age group, right? I have a 9-year-old and I'm very involved in the library books that he checks out. And there are absolutely books that I would not let him check out that are on that list. But that's where the debate is, right? How much of this is up to the librarians and how much is up to the parents? And, you know, regardless of what happens with this bill that was, passed out of committee yesterday, it's not going to be the end of the debate.
No, I agree 100%. Kalama, you had an update this week on the Lori and Chad Daybell murder case, specifically on how much the case has already cost taxpayers. You folks over at East Idaho News did a little checking. What's the grand total so far?
So far, it is over $3.5 million.
Whoa.
A large chunk of that is out of Fremont County, where the investigation was taking place. Expected over $5 million if you include the cost of both Chad and Lori's trials. They are going to be tried separately.
But we haven't even had a trial yet, right?
Excuse me?
We haven't even had a trial yet.
No, that is before the trial. It's about $3.6 million before the trial.
And what has all that money been spent on? You mentioned the investigation. I mean, they've had to bring in people and...
So there was obviously with the death penalty prosecution, there's not a lot of experience coming out of Madison or Fremont County. So they actually brought in a special prosecutor, Rachel Smith from Missouri, who has some background in death penalty prosecution. There was also some cost for Lori Vallow's competency evaluation and her being held during that evaluation. There's a lot of, obviously, legal fees, public defenders and prosecutorial and just kind of law enforcement and investigative costs. Everything is kind of just ballooning because of how much investigation has gone into this. And it's only going to tick up more when the trials are held finally, which is starting just over 2 weeks with Lori on April 3rd.
That's right. That's going to be in Boise, correct?
Yes, that is correct, actually. See, on a report that you'll find on East Idaho News published Wednesday, she will be transferred to Ada County next week. So she'll be in Ada County jail by March 25th at the latest. The trial will begin April 3rd. Prospective jurors will fill out questionnaires March 27th, March 28th. So it is... It is getting almost, for lack of a better term, go time in April or in Ada, sorry, for this trial.
Absolutely. And then, as you said, the trials have been split. So we'll have to wait probably quite a while before Chad's trial.
Yeah. Chad's trial has not even been set. And actually, so just this week, there were some motions filed by the defense teams of Lori Vallow, a motion to compel. They want Lori's defense team wants all recorded and written statements that prosecution has from Chad. They have not received that yet, they say. Also, there was a motion to exclude late disclosed evidence. So Judge Boyce said disclosure needed to be completed by February 27th. And the defense team says that on February 27th, they received what they called a 5,000-page dump, along with hours of audio and video, which they want all that to be excluded from the trial. Also, there was a motion to dismiss death penalty over, among other things, that late dump of evidence. So all of those motions will be considered, and Judge Boyce will be making a decision next week, March 22nd.
All right. Well, we know you guys are going to stay on it. Again, this case not going away anytime soon, and it will continue. Okay, so Melissa and Christina, and hi, Christina. Sorry I haven't got you in earlier. It's been busy. Let's talk about this story. A new report shows Idaho's shortage of direct care workers is worse than the national average. Christina, what's going on here? Why is this the case?
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me. On Thursday, the Idaho Performance of Evaluations released a report to a legislative committee known as the Joint Legislative Oversight Council that found that the state needs at least 3,000 more direct care workers to serve our senior citizens in Idaho and Idahoans with disabilities. These folks help people get dressed, help people eat, help with their transportation, help with counseling, some nursing services, those sort of things. It's all in an effort to keep people in their homes rather than having to transition to long-term care or assisted living facilities. So the report, I'm sorry, my cat is meowing in the background because of course, but the report found Idaho's direct care workforce shortage is worse than the national average. Part of the reason is because their pay is capped by Medicaid rates, which are set by the state. So according to the report, 76% of the 900 direct care workers surveyed by the OPE said that higher pay would actually help keep them from leaving their jobs. And this is super important because the Idaho's direct care workforce is about 23,000 people. But the report found that Idaho would need an additional 3,000 direct care workers to get up to these national staffing levels. And of course, as more and more people discover Idaho and move here, that number is expected to increase. The report found that number is actually expected to triple by 2032. And the report estimates that 9,500 additional workers in this field would be needed. When we have less people doing this work, we have worse health outcomes and that sort of thing. So the report really showed that that we could really use some help in this particular topic area.
Well, you talk about 3,000 and you talk about that tripling in 10 years. How are we supposed to get all those folks? Does the report?
Right.
I mean,
well, the report does offer some suggestions to confront the problem, including really getting at that competitive wage issue by using wage targets that are similar to other competitive occupations. They also recommend adjusting the Medicaid rates more frequently. Right now, Medicaid rates are set every 5 years, but there is the possibility for the state to update them more frequently to stay in line with changing trends and these industries. And then they also recommended considering different Medicaid rates specific to different parts of the state. So if you have a higher cost of living in one area, you could increase those Medicaid rates for that particular space.
Okay. That's wow. Let's stick with the legislature. Election bills. We've had a few. We've got a few more. We had one that that failed, I believe. Idaho House killed it this week. Melissa, give us a rundown. Christina, chime in as well.
Quite a few election issues in front of the legislature this year, and a lot of them saw movement this week. The bill to ban student IDs as a valid form of ID at the polls, that went to the governor's office. He signed that on Wednesday. This morning in State Affairs, our Ruth Brown reported that they passed two bills to the broader House floor. One of them would ban the affidavits that voters can sign if they don't have a valid form of ID with them. Legal document basically saying, I am who I say I am. I actually had to use that 1 year when I forgot my wallet in at my house and had a crying baby with me. And so very, you know, not widely used, but it is used by some people. There was also a bill that got sent for amendments that would create a free identification for people who don't otherwise have a driver's license or a passport or a military ID, other valid forms of ID that are accepted at the polls. This was kind of meant to make up for taking away the student ID, saying, you know what, college students who don't have driver's licenses, here's a free option for you that the Idaho Transportation Department would provide. That is up to be amended. And then, of course, there's the election component of the massive property tax bill that would do away with March elections for school levies and bonds. That's something that a lot of school districts are concerned about because they rely on that election date for supplemental funds. They go to voters and they ask, you know, for these extra funds to help out. That was part of a compromise property tax bill that covers a lot of ground. That's just one tiny, tiny part of it. One bill that isn't going to move forward, that died on the House floor on Monday, was a proposal to do away with no excuse absentee voting. This right now, Idaho, anyone can request an absentee ballot for no reasons. In fact, there are actually a few precincts in Idaho that don't have physical voting locations, that the very rural areas where everybody votes absentee. This would make it so that, or it would have made it so that you could only request an absentee ballot if you're going to be out of the state for approved reasons, or if you're disabled. That went down on Monday and is a done deal for the session.
Okay. Wow. All right. Nicole, we haven't heard from you. You had an in-depth story on how Idaho counts wolves and whether it's an accurate method. Give us a little background. What's going on here?
Sure. So to understand what the issue is, you kind of have to understand how Idaho has been counting wolves since they were reintroduced in the mid-1990s. Fish and Game and other agencies have been using some pretty traditional methods. So a lot of radio collaring of wolves, a lot of aerial surveys to count how many there are, stuff that's pretty widely accepted. And in the mid-2010s, so around like 2016, they decided to start looking into some less intensive options because those aerial surveys, that radio collaring is expensive. It takes a lot of personnel. And so they've worked with researchers to develop a method that uses trail cameras placed around the state. So they have been solely relying on these trail cameras and the photos that they take since 2019. And those have given us an estimate over the last several years, around 1,500 wolves. In January, Fish and Game officials said that that number is actually starting to decline to around 1,300. And I got interested in this because, you know, it's not the first time that I've heard people criticize this trail camera method, but Fish and Game did address it in a January commission meeting when they were introducing a new management plan for wolves. So if this management plan is accepted by the Fish and Game Commission in May, it would basically put the state on track to reduce the wolf population from where it is around 1,300, according to their estimates, down to about 500 animals. So I was interested just in taking a look at that and seeing where these concerns are coming from as far as the accuracy of the trail camera method. So it relies on a statistical model. There's like a lot of kind of technical mathematical elements to this. So I'll try and kind of pare it down as much as I can. But essentially, there is a way to calculate the number of animals based on how many photographs you have to look at before you detect those animals. That method, the way that it was devised, it relies on photos that are all taken at one time. So if 500 cameras around the state all take a picture at noon, you can't have a photo of a wolf and two of the same photos if the cameras are spread out, which gives you an accurate idea of where they are and you're not double counting them. So Fish and Game has tweaked that a little bit. They are using some motion triggered photographs. And they also have tweaked where they're placing the cameras. So the original statistical model calls for just completely random placement of cameras. Fish and Game has instead put their cameras facing roads and trails. They told me that is because wolves travel almost exclusively on those kind of established trails and roadways. And critics have said, you know, you're skewing things to the point where we think that you are really overestimating how many animals there are based on the changes that you've made to this this statistical model. So there are a couple of researchers with Montana State University and University of Wisconsin-Madison who have called out Fish and Game, submitted some complaints to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and said, hey, we think that the way that they have adjusted this model has made it pretty inaccurate, and we're worried that they're going to start reducing the wolf population based on a number that we don't think is correct.
Well, that's the end point, right? If their number is not correct, that could affect not only how many wolves there are, if you have fewer than you think you do and you kill a bunch of them, then they could end up back on the endangered species list or could not survive.
Right. So one big concern that that critics of the method have is, you know, Idaho is under a contract with the federal government, or has an agreement with the government, that we will maintain about 150 wolves. There's like a certain number of breeding pairs that we have to have. There are certain signs of a healthy population that we agreed to maintain. And so folks are worried that if this number is off and we think that we're getting down to around 500, maybe there's a chance we're actually getting below 100. And in that case, our wolf population goes back under Endangered Species Act protection, and Idaho Fish and Game no longer has control over the wolf population. That will go back to the federal government.
Wow. Okay. So we'll wait and see what happens, see if they're accurate.
Mm-hmm. Fish and Game, for its part, I should say, has stood by its method and has said that it has checked the tweaks that it's made and that it's confident that it is producing an accurate count.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And joining us, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. Hi, Audrey.
Hello.
Hey.
Happy Friday.
Thanks. Let's talk about Happy Friday, and then let's talk about a disturbing story that you had this week about a Boise junior high social worker. Quick note, this story includes mentions of sexual assault and suicide. Audrey, give us the basics of what happened, because this is a little complicated.
Yeah, it is not a happy story. Last year there was a social worker at Fairmont Junior High School who was being investigated for allegations related to an inappropriate relationship with a student who was in their early teens. After his phone was taken after a traffic stop by police during that investigation, he took his own life. And in kind of the wake of that, after that, the principal was charged with failure to report suspected child abuse. So that is going on now in the courts, that principal, and the kind of one of the things that I heard from parents and talked with some parents about this. And one of the things that they're concerned about is that the school did not tell them about any of this. The principal was put on administrative leave and then put into a job basically at the school district as an administrator, administrative consultant, something like that, but in an administrative role. And parents didn't hear anything about this or about the allegations against the social worker. And so the story kind of goes into what I've heard from a couple of students' parents who were not involved in this initial investigation allegation, but also have concerns about their children being pulled out of class into the social worker's office repeatedly. And being absent from class, but having the absences excused, receiving gifts, the social worker turning off the lights and allowing them to take naps while he worked at his desk. So there are a lot of concerns that are raised, and the big picture is that the parents really would like there to be some kind of policy changes to keep this from happening again. Because the alleged events that they're hearing about now, they say, you know, if policies that were in place right now for training, for the ability to for educators to detect grooming or anything else that seems like it might be crossing a boundary, or, you know, where they can report those potential issues. If those policies and procedures were working, this would not have gone on for as long as they say it did. So, that's the long and short of it. It is not a good situation, and the parents are really, they really want to see some changes made.
Well, that and you go into a couple of different issues into this story. One is, there's being able to share information, and then as some of the school districts have said, you know, there's personnel information that they can or can't release, and that's one issue. And then the other is training. You found out it was up to school districts to decide on training what or if any that teachers and staff get on how to spot bad behavior, right? So it's a district by district thing.
Right. And that's when it comes to like continuing education kind of training. So when you are in school to pre-educator training in school, like at Boise State University, you would take ethics as part of that. Like you would get some training in that. And when you apply to be a certified educator, you have to sign something that says that you have read and will abide by the code of ethics. And the code of ethics goes into what is appropriate as in terms of student educator relationships. I'll also say, you know, social worker, all of the mental health professions have really clear ethics kind of boundaries. And those boards of licensure handle those kinds of situations. But yes, it's district by district how much of an emphasis they want to put on various different types of teacher in-services and staff training and things like that. As far as the disclosure goes, Boise School District said that they are not allowed under Idaho code, and the code they cited was a public records code. They're not allowed to provide any information about grievances against anybody who's employed by a public agency. So I, you know, and I responded back and I said, hey, just this week, the Twin Falls School District put out a public statement about one of its staff who had been charged with a crime related to allegedly having sex with a student. Were they not, you know, were they in violation for sharing this information, or could Boise Schools have shared this information? And the response I got was, we won't comment on what, you know, another school district does. We will say that this is the code where we are not allowed to divulge that information. So where does that leave us? I don't know. But parents would like to be informed when there's something like this. And one of the things they pointed out was parents of two of the students that I talked, well, the parents I talked with of two students said they heard about this from another parent. They never heard about it from the schools. And only then did they think to ask their children, because they knew that they had been working with a social worker. Hey, what were your interactions with him like? And that's when they found out, you know, that they'd been spending a lot of time in his office, that he had pulled them out of class, some text messages, personal text messages, gifts and things like that. So that's why they want there to be some public notification so that they would have known earlier to ask their children about this.
It's a tricky situation for sure. I think one line in your story really got to me. It was at least six educators in Idaho have been formally disciplined since the start of 2022 for alleged conduct with students. And I think that's where you're getting into some of that concern with parents. And then, you know, how do you disseminate information if you can? Not an easy topic.
No, it's not. And one thing to keep in mind is that's six educators over, you know, since January 2022. I went through and looked through all the disciplinary actions and thought, oh, well, here are six. The thing to keep in mind is there are like, what, almost 20, 21,000 or something like that educators working in Idaho. So this isn't something that's like a rampant problem. But, you know, one case of somebody crossing a boundary can have great effect on a child, particularly, you know, when they're developing their trust levels and their place in the world and where they fit into everything. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, there's more in the story. Go read it. Audrey, thanks a lot. Ian, we had a lot of rain and snow over the past week. A lot. So how is Idaho's snowpack doing?
Well, most of the basins and watersheds in central and southern Idaho are well above normal with snowpack, which means that there's a lot more snow than there is during an average year. And that bodes well for the runoff this spring and summer when that water melts and supplies the water levels in the rivers that run into our reservoir systems, which then feed our agricultural water and things like that. And so the National Weather Service thinks that due to this snowy and wet winter, likely Idaho, which has been in drought for a number of years, much of the state will likely get out of drought. So I think that'll be hopefully pleasing to hear for a number of people.
Well, that's really good news. I mean, I know we've had a few of these snowpack reports that have been very cautious sounding, very concerned. But with all the rain and snow, that's good news to hear.
Yeah, I should add that the snowpack calculations are a bit complicated, and it's more than just how much snow there is on the ground in the mountains. There are other factors involved that can affect how much snow ends up in the rivers and streams. For instance, soil moisture can have a big effect. At the moment, we do have, they also calculate that number, the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture. And the soil moisture levels in a lot of the state are pretty low. And soil, when the snow melts, it acts basically like a sponge and it absorbs water. So some of that water that is in the snowpack will likely be absorbed in the soil and therefore not run off into the streams and rivers. So that's, I think, part of the reason that sometimes in these predictions, they're unsure of how much water we'll actually get. But I think given the large amount of percentages above normal, like a lot of watersheds are at 139% of normal, 148% of normal,
nice,
in the Big Wood and Little Wood rivers. That'll be enough to still get us over the out of drought.
That is good to hear, definitely. Christina, let's head back to the legislature for just a minute. Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador has been in the news a bunch this week. And also this week, the Idaho House said no to his budget. What was the issue?
Yeah. So the Attorney General, Raul Labrador, who was elected in November and put into office in January, requested an 11% raise, 11% increase, excuse me, in his budget for raises for attorneys and other staff members within his office. The budget made it out of JFAC and onto the House floor, but legislators had some concerns about the steep increase that the office was asking for, which is more than for what most state employees will expect to receive. So Labrador said we need 11% raises for attorneys and staff in the AG's office to keep up with competitive norms and other salaries for similar positions in other law firms or in other public agencies. But legislators had issue approving that amount of an increase in his budget because other state employees aren't receiving the same amount, including law enforcement through Idaho State Police. So the budget will go back to JFAC and be worked Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, which is the powerful budget setting committee for the legislature. We'll have to take another look at this. Idaho doesn't have a set date to adjourn the legislative session, but the mandate that allows the legislature to adjourn is making sure that all of literally more than 100 state budgets are set. So the budget committee will have to go back and tweak this before they can adjourn. They're hoping to adjourn. Their set date is March 24th, next Friday. But budget bills kind of can be adjusted quickly, and it may or may not affect the adjournment of the legislature this year.
And to be clear, Attorney General Labrador's salary is set separately, and the increase he's looking for is for his staff.
Yeah, that's a good point. The legislature set his salary at a little bit more than $146,000 per year last year in a budget bill last year. And this is just for other folks within that office, including other deputy attorneys and things like that.
Gotcha. All right. And Ian, we did not get to your story about the Boise City Council member stepping down to become CEO. So everybody check it out. It's a good story. And we won't tell you who it is if you don't already know. So you have to go find out. We've been speaking with Kalama Hines, reporter with EastIdahoNews.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Nicole Blanchard with the Idaho Statesman, she's the outdoors reporter, Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, and Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. I want to thank everybody for being on the show today, and check out all their stories. They did some good stuff this week. Yesterday on Idaho Matters, we talked about a lawsuit against the Idaho Attorney General's office. 35 school districts and nonprofits are suing the AG over his use of what are known as civil investigatory demands, or CIDs, calling them overreaching. The Attorney General's office sent us this statement on the case. Quote, "This investigation is in its preliminary phase. A civil investigatory demand is a fact-finding tool. The authority to issue a CID comes from Idaho Code, sections 48-1908, 48-1203, and 1204, and 48-611. We have had productive and cooperative conversations with several entities." The AG's office continues, "Those who have cooperated understand that the purpose of the investigation is not to punish child care providers, but to enlist their help to determine whether state law was followed. They go on, "We will zealously defend the powers the legislature has given us to ensure compliance with Idaho law." That's the end of the Attorney General's statement. And we have extended our invitation to the Attorney General to come on Idaho Matters to talk more about this story. I'm Samantha Wright, and you're listening to Idaho Matters.
Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.